This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Tons of books available now about finding the right college and rating colleges and universities and listing the best of this and the best of that in higher education and basically trying to teach you and your child how to choose a college. But a college professional says those books and most parents and students are doing it wrong.
Too many kids and too many parents begin with, am I right for the college? Whereas I think you should start with is always. Is the college right for me?
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to that educator about how he believes families should tackle that decision and what he did when it was his family's turn. We'll also spend an academic minute learning how colleges can produce students with a purpose. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. About this little situation for a minute. You're a professional who studies trends in college enrollment and admissions and helping students make the right choice. Then all of a sudden, it's time for your own kids to start choosing a school. That's the situation John McGee recently faced. His solution? Ask friends and colleagues from colleges around the country to pen letters to parents about all the different aspects of sending a child off to school. McGee built those letters into the foundation of his new book called Dear Parents, A Field Guide for College Preparation. John McGee is Vice President for Planning and Strategy at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota. I asked him how he took his life situation and turned it into this book.
Professionally, I've been writing about this and studying it for a while. The publisher called me and said, I'd written another book and said, would you be willing to write a book to parents? And I said, that would be great. I have four kids. I'm going through the college process now. As I started writing, my oldest had already started college. And we'll have a child in college every year from 2015 to 2027 with no breaks. And for the next 5 years, we'll have two in college at the same time. So that put me in a position to both understand this personally and combine what I know professionally about this experience. And as we went through it as a family, my wife and I and my kids, I thought I knew at the beginning of this a lot more than in the end I probably did. And what I had especially underestimated with my own kids is that how emotional this process really is. I mean, there are kids, and you can know about this intellectually, and you can know how the steps go and all of that. And there's a lot of steps to follow. But to experience it yourself and to think about it, you know, what's best for my child? Are they going to be okay? All the same hopes and fears and dreams that everybody else has. So that was kind of the genesis of the book. And I had intended to write the book around letters that I would write. But a friend of mine said, don't do that. Ask us. So ask other people who work, your friends in higher education who have kids. How have they thought about college for their own kids? And from that idea, a book was born that doesn't tell you how to fill out a college application, doesn't tell you how to fill out a financial aid application, doesn't give a list of 10 top colleges, but is designed to provide insights into just how to think about college, how to guide your children, and hopefully, and this was a big deal to me, hopefully how to reduce some of the anxiety that swirls around this process, some of which colleges create and some of which parents and students create for themselves.
Do you think that anxiety was heightened a little bit for someone like you who deals with college admission numbers constantly and then all of a sudden one of those numbers is someone you recognize?
Yeah, a little bit. I have to tell you, I didn't get that anxious, and I never have gotten that anxious about my kids because I know I never got, and this is one of the things I wanted to write about, I've never sort of been sucked into the trap that there was just one institution, one perfect place where my kids had to go. I've had the opportunity to work with lots and lots of colleges in a variety of different roles over a long period of time and know that there are many, many tremendous schools. I also know and knew that students are the primary input to their own outcome. I mean, how hard they work to what they aspire largely shapes their experience no matter where they go. But I saw, you know, I have family members with kids going into college, friends with kids going into college, and all of this anxiety came into play, but that anxiety shaped really in a lot of ways by two things. First, just the cost. The price of college has risen faster than family incomes. It can be very significant and a daunting investment, and that raises the stakes and levels of anxiety for students and parents alike. The other is that the process, which I had honestly not thought a lot about before we got into the process of looking at and applying to schools, the process of applying, and this is the thick season right now, can be very confusing. There's lots of names that go with this process that are not intuitive to people, things like early action, early decision, priority, rolling admission, early restricted admission, regular admission, wait lists, all stuff that's not really intuitive to families. And I think sometimes families don't know or parents don't know, especially people who are new to the process, that not only can you ask lots of questions, you should ask lots of questions. You should never fear picking up the phone and asking a question about the process. It will not hurt your chances for enrollment, your son or daughter's chances for enrollment. And you really need to know.
I want to get back to the admissions in just a bit, but I'd like to find out how you found your letter writers, because there's quite a variety of different people and styles of writing in there.
Well, it helps to have really interesting, wonderful friends at institutions all over the country. And so these were all people that I know. And they're also, with only a couple of exceptions, they're people with kids either not yet in college or in college now. They are people that I know well, people that I felt comfortable asking, and each one got a particular prompt question. So they all got a different question based on what I knew about them and stories they had told me or about their families. And I tried to mix it up from institutions in different parts of the country, people in different roles. So, for example, one of the great ones was a letter from the financial aid director at Stanford, Karen Cooper, who's a very good friend and colleague. I didn't ask her to write about financial aid. Her three kids have had really different kinds of experiences, and how did she and her family go through those experiences in different ways with their three very different children? And she wrote the letter, and when she sent it in, she said, "This was really hard. I thought you might ask me about financial aid." I said, "No, I wanted to make this way more personal, not just a professional experience, but a personal experience." And that's what they wrote about. Some are more deeply personal than others. And I learned a lot. It was one of the great things about writing this book was how much I got to learn from the 17 letters that appear in the book.
I'll tell you, one of the greatest lines from one of those letters was, and I did not write down who said it, but I wrote down the quote, "They're looking to raise a great 35-year-old.
Yeah, that I thought was such an insightful comment, that it's easy to make this into kind of an antiseptic, where should I go to college process, and what can I major in, and is there a job waiting at the end? All of that's important. But at the end of the day, I think as parents, what we hope for the most of all is that our children, having gone through these experiences, become not just successful people in the ways that society measures success or economic success, but good people, wonderful people, people that we want to be with, people that other people want to be with. Those are the kinds of lines in those letters that added perspective to this search that often does not get considered.
You talked also in the book about how college has changed. It's no longer, 4 years, get a bachelor's, go home. You've got 4-year, 2-year certificate, technical schools. There's so many different choices now.
Well, there's choices in a variety of ways. First, I don't believe anymore that 4 years of college or perhaps even graduate school is sort of the sort of hard stop end to learning. That formal learning even will occur in a variety of ways over the lifetimes of people who are young now. The economy is changing so rapidly, and the tools by which the economy operates are changing so fastly. It's not just kind of you finished college and now you're done for the rest of your life. But I also wanted to address in the book that college comes in forms and flavors that people sometimes don't think about. So when they say, "Did you go to college?" and somebody has been to a 2-year college, the answer is yes, which is why I wrote this story about my niece, Grace, who was an honor student at a suburban high school in the Twin Cities. Her parents, my brother and sister-in-law, had 4-year college. Everybody in her family, 4-year college graduate. And she chose to head off to complete a program in machine tool technology at a 2-year program. And she was very assertive and clear about why she did that. But she got questions the summer before she went when people would ask, "What are you doing?" And people who just assumed that she was going to go to a four-year institution, that she would follow that path. And she told them, "And well, why aren't you going to college?" Or, oh, sort of looking at her sadly about the choice she'd made. It was a terrific choice for her. And so I think the takeaway to that for me, given the forms and flavors that college comes in today, is to encourage kids to look at the place that best fits them, not the other way around. And for parents to listen to their children about their aspirations and about what they want to do and really think about what their abilities are so that we don't misplay that, well, you have to pursue this kind of education when, in fact, this kind of education would be better.
You just used one of the words. I have two words written down here that I think are two of the most important that you talk about in the book. One is fit, finding the right fit. The other is value.
Yeah.
Talk about how those go together.
Well, on fit, I will say I wrote about this. I tried to get my own kids to do it. It is way harder to do this when you're the parent and you're writing about this. On fit, I think too many kids and too many parents begin with, am I right for the college? And they try to sort of piece themselves into that puzzle, whereas I think you should start with is always, is the college right for me? And I said this at a presentation I gave to parents the other night at a school in the Twin Cities. Beware the seduction of shiny objects. That I think that kids and parents should start with a question, I am, I expect, I value, I need. Complete those four sentences. Use emojis if you want. Kids, you don't have to tell your parents how you filled it out, but you should think about that for yourself, because each of those sentences provides a tool for self-understanding that will help them go a long ways towards making a good match. A very good friend of mine, Frank Sachs, he's a former director of college counseling at the Blake Schools in Minneapolis, and his email salutation has forever said, a college is a match to be made, not a prize to be won. And I think that is incredibly wise advice, and that's where I got those four sentences. How that fits with value is that you need to know what this particular place is worth to you, what it will do to you, what kinds of things you expect to get out of going to one school or another, and think about that. It obviously can't shape how much you can pay, but it may influence how much you're willing to pay to go to college. Colleges look often a lot alike, and so you have to dig deep sometimes to ask questions about value. So by virtue of asking, I am, I expect, I value, I need, knowing that about yourself, you're better positioned to visit colleges, to consider colleges, to apply to colleges, or to choose a final college on the basis of, this is who I am, this is what I've learned this college does, I value that, I wish to go there.
Our conversation with John McGee continues with a look at the good school, bad school labels that some colleges get. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is John McGee, Vice President for Planning and Strategy at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota. We're talking about his new book. It's called Dear Parents, A Field Guide for College Preparation. He spoke about the importance of finding a college that's right for each student. Then we started talking about the concept of good schools and bad schools.
I really resist the notion of the language of good school, bad school, as if there are objectively good or bad. When it's, is it right for me or not right for me? It's also one of the reasons why I dislike the use of the term safety school, which comes into play often when kids are applying to college, which means you're going to apply to a college you may not get into, that would be a stretch school, but you're going to apply to one or two or several that you're pretty sure you can get into, and you call them safety schools. I think the phrase safety school is pejorative both to the college and to the student. I mean, at the end of the day, yes, you should apply to colleges that you are pretty sure you can get into. where you'll get a yes admission decision. But that doesn't make it a safety school. That might make it an extraordinary fit for you.
This book is probably going to be put in the same section in the bookstore and the library as the guidebooks. What's wrong with the guidebooks?
Well, I'm not so sure anything's objectively wrong with the guidebooks, except to say that they're highly influenced by inputs. They provide a handy way for kicking off a college search and defining kind of basic boundaries. But I think that's about as far as they go. They overwhelmingly focus on inputs. How many of this, that, or the other thing? How much do you spend per student? You know, what's your alum giving rate? Some of those things are in guidebooks. It's not that that's unimportant, but those books rarely, if ever, describe what students might actually experience. They don't provide insights into a school's soul, purpose, experience, or value. They just don't. And so my take on guidebooks is sort of beware. Use them perhaps to understand something about some basic information about an institution. But when any guidebook, and many of them do, say best for this or that, well, that depends on who you are. And so I go back to the fit and the value question again. It depends on who you are. Is this institution the very best institution in the country? Well, according perhaps to this guidebook, it is. But it isn't for me. You have to be careful to use guidebooks to lead you rather than to be led by the guidebooks.
I loved your description of move-in day in the book. That's something, you know, you work at a college, so you probably experience that every year.
Every year, and it's the most wonderful day of the year and the hardest day of the year. The wonderful day part is that everybody's excited on move-in day. You've got current students pitching in and faculty and staff, and the presidents are usually there moving boxes and meeting with families. Kids are schooled to look forward to move-in day. Parents, however, are very often wistful. Kids think, oh, the places I'll go. Parents think at that moment often, oh, the places we've been. And I knew that I was going to feel that emotionally. And I, every year, participate in move-in day at my campuses. But when it was my own child, especially my oldest, the first one in, I was really incredibly wistful because it made everything come together. 18 years goes by really fast. And the infant or the toddler or the small child that you played with and then you went to all their events in school is suddenly moving out. And it's move-in day for kids. But from the vantage point of parents, there's a sort of move-out day quality to it. And it causes a reset, I think, in sort of the parent-child relationship. They're an adult when they're here. They make their own decisions. We hope they make good decisions. We hope we prepared them to make good decisions. I admit I was really quite sad on move-in day, partly because of this temptation to look backwards. Now, what's funny is that 4 years later, when they graduate, parents are almost never wistful at college graduation. Every year at commencement exercises, they are filled with joy. It's the students who are often wistful, both because this is now the transition point to the rest of their lives in many ways, and because they formed all these incredible relationships, certainly at my schools, which are residential colleges, that now are going to change a lot, and they feel sad about that. So it's kind of interesting that in 4 years it all flips. I included in the book a letter I wrote to my oldest son when he went to college. That was a really late addition to the book. I had not intended to include that, but thought I needed to do that both because it offered some advice, but also because it was sort of cathartic for me, and I thought it would be for others to say, this is a way to think about this moment.
Well, one other quote I'll take from the book was, many are called, far fewer complete. Once they're in, is there something a parent can do to help keep them in, or is that just up to the student and the school and you got to watch?
Well, I don't think it's quite that. I think a lot of it is up to the student and up to the school, and students don't finish for a variety of reasons. Some of them academic, some of them health-related, some of them socially related. I think that especially when a student moves away to go to school and we don't, as parents, see them every day like we perhaps had before, it's harder to know what's going on in their lives. I think that that's a really good question you asked, because I didn't exactly address that straight up in the book. They're 18 or older. We're not at that point managing all the day-to-day of their lives. They are making choices. but we can check in. And I think it puts a premium on us listening and listening carefully to what it is they're experiencing. One of my letter writers, or two actually, they're a couple who teach at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University, Betsy Johnson Miller and Shane Miller, wrote about their experience with their daughter who, when she went away, she didn't have a good experience. And they knew that she was likely to transfer, but they didn't want to tell her that that's what she ought to do. So instead, they asked her questions, and they wrote about that to try to get her to understand her experience where she was. And it turns out that through their sort of gentle guidance, their listening, they were tapped into her life without being intrusive in her life. She did choose to transfer and has subsequently had a wonderful experience. So some of this is just about, in not always directive ways or ways that we're used to as parents, but checking in. How's it going? Do you need anything? You know, it's sort of a variation on the thing you ask students, your kids when they're younger. How was your day? What did you do today? It doesn't have to be quite like that. Part of it is just, are you fine? And then listening carefully to how they respond.
He is Vice President for Planning and Strategy at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota. The name of his new book is Dear Parents, A Field Guide for College Preparation. Purpose in life is a pretty good first step for college students. But what exactly does it take to produce purposeful students? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Having a purpose is a great first step for college graduates. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Tim Clydesdale, professor of sociology at the College of New Jersey, explores how students can find their purpose.
What does it take for colleges to produce purposeful graduates? That is, graduates clear about the direction they want their life to take and committed to values that will drive their work, graduate study, community involvement, and even formation of families. The answer may surprise you. For 8 years, 88 colleges and universities launched programs that invited students to consider the ideas of purpose, calling, and vocation in their own lives. Some campuses created weekend retreats. Some added reflection programming to residential halls. Some created courses on work and meaning. Some infused service into upper-level seminars, and virtually all offered mentored internship programs. I studied 24 campuses, interviewing hundreds of students, alumni, faculty, and staff, and surveying thousands. On campuses, I met communities of students and of faculty and staff, actively engaging the idea of a purposeful life. And I tracked down alumni whose lives were more intentional and resilient than non-participant peers. 84% of student participants confirmed that reflection on their purpose or calling had been helpful to them, and 2/3 valued these programs with helping them identify their skills and talents. 85% of faculty participants and 93% of staff said these programs deepened their appreciation for the mission of their college or university. Strikingly, over 80% of campuses continued these programs even after their initial funding expired, and there is now a network of 228 campuses involved in this effort. Purpose exploration programs do not appeal to everyone, but to the many who choose to participate, the idea of purpose, combined with good conversations and real-life settings in which to explore interest, is both beneficial and lasting.
That was Tim Clydesdale of the College of New Jersey. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barron. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.